We live in a fantasy world now. Reality has been destroyed.
This is the time that we really need to pay attention.
The probabilities are overwhelmingly on gold's side.
That is the best environment to see gold increase its value.
Welcome to Palisades Gold Radio. I'm your host, Tom Bodrovics. Joining me today is Jim Welsh, founder and publisher of Macro Tides, with over 40 years of experience of investing and portfolio management. How are you today, Jim?
I'm doing good, Tom. I hope you're doing well, too.
I'm excellent, and it's good to have you. You came highly recommended from our mutual friend, Dale Pinkert. Yep. So I've been looking forward to this conversation here.
Well, me too.
So you combine both technical and fundamental analysis. So is this helpful because you're able to confirm one with the other when you're looking at certain data?
Tom, that's exactly spot on. The synergy, when there is synergy, to me provides more conviction that an outcome is a lot more likely to happen in the markets. And you know what got me down this path very quickly, long, long time ago, I read a book called Stock Market Logic, which was published in the mid-70s. And the guy used a mainframe computer to evaluate 65 indicators as to their predictive value. Mm-hmm. And the ones that had the highest probability were all related to interest rates, monetary policy. So that's what drove me, if you will, to really focus on monetary policy. I have hand-drawn charts starting in 1966 for the Fed funds, T-bill rates, all kinds of rates, all right? And then there were a number of technicians that I stumbled across that kind of, I thought, wow, this is really pretty interesting stuff to evaluate the market from a different angle. And then over time, just learning how to put it together. Mm-hmm. But the main thing is, like coming into this year, the expectation was that the Fed was going to be shifting toward tightening monetary policy and that the market would react negatively to that. And that's why I thought, all right, a 10 to 15% correction in the first part of the year was likely as that shift took place and people realized that, hey, the Fed is going to slow the economy.
So, you know, considering that you have so many years of experience, as you say, you had charts going back to the 60s, have you seen, you know, the effect of monetary policy shift over that time, or is there something that you've picked up on that has changed over that time?
Oh, absolutely. A couple things. As we all know, interest rates peaked in 1980, 81, both in terms of like the 10-year above 15%. It's hard to fathom, but the Fed funds rate was up to 20%. Mm-hmm. And then we saw a 40-year period of time where rates came down, hit a lower low, then a lower high, and they've been working down ever since. And eventually what the Fed had to do starting in 2000 is to push the federal funds rate below inflation so that the real rate was negative. And then the next step in response to the financial crisis was to introduce quantitative easing because their policy rate is the Fed funds rate, which controls short-term stuff. QE was intended to bring longer-term rates down, which they did. So we have a Fed whose balance sheet was $900 billion in 2007, and it's almost $9 trillion as we're talking right now. Mm-hmm. So the shift in monetary policy has been a progressive move toward more and more accommodation. And it led to, and this is, I think, really important for where we are today. For decades, Tom, the Fed, once the unemployment rate would drop to a low level, and they have a measurement called NARO to determine, gee, what is the low level? The Fed would start to raise rates in anticipation that low unemployment would equal higher wage gains, which then would feed into inflation. So they would be preemptive by raising rates in anticipation that inflation would show up. Well, what happened in August of 2018, the Fed completely changed their framework and they went to average inflation targeting. The main point being is we're going to allow the economy to run hot because there are benefits to those at the lower end of the labor spectrum, the bottom 20 to 40% of wage earners. Because in 2018 and 19, those folks had greater increases in wage growth than everybody else. So the Fed said, you know what, we're going to, in a sense, overweight the labor market relative to stable inflation. and we're going to wait for inflation to show up. As I wrote at the time, their timing couldn't have been worse, because we were going to get a bout of inflation for a lot of different reasons, and they were going to be behind the curve right from the get-go. Mm-hmm. And that has obviously proven to be the case. So yeah, the way monetary policy has changed has a lot. And then one other point I'd make, and I think it's important, Tom, most people in this business, you know, 30 years of experience, they've never experienced a 40-year high in inflation. Mm-hmm. And a central bank that has to respond to that. The other thing that has taken place is the correlation between stocks and bonds kind of went upside down from 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s. Stocks and bonds pretty much moved together. Once we got past 2000, what we saw is when the market lost 49% between 2000 and 2003, treasury yields came down a lot. So if you had a 60-40 allocation, 60 to stocks, 40 bonds, you did okay. And in 2007-08, the financial crisis, it worked even better. I wrote last year that I thought that that relationship was going to revert back to the way it had been for decades, where we would see bond and stock prices move together. Mm-hmm. And that's what we've seen. This year is like the worst in decades for anybody with a 60-40 allocation. So yeah, to me, the changes in monetary policy and how they've been perceived have really kind of been profound. Mm-hmm.
So with the advent of quantitative easing, do you feel that that has, I mean, obviously we can look to all of the quote unquote bubbles that that has blown up, but you know, you and I spoke before the call today about the fact that this has really driven everybody else up the risk curve. So do you see that quantitative easing having that effect on everybody else in the market?
Absolutely. I mean, the whole idea of fear of missing out, there is no alternative, buy the dip. You know, all those things are a reflection of investors believing that the Fed is going to maintain accommodation. And if we hit a speed bump, they're going to come to our rescue. Mm-hmm. And that was built up over, you know, many, many years of people learning that this is the way the system works. And I believe that we're going to come to a point in time sometime in the next few years where the realization is going to be that the Fed doesn't have the same leverage and ability, if you will, to turn the tide as they have in the past. And I think when that comes, it's going to usher in a secular bear market that lasts 15 years or more, comparable in terms of stocks from the 1966 to 1982 timeframe. Mm-hmm. And I point out to people, Tom, because everybody's, the Fed put, you know, there really is no such thing as a Fed put, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. Mm-hmm. But the idea that the Fed will come to the rescue is so ingrained that, you know, people just have absolute faith in it. At the same time, with the irony here, Tom, is, you know, in 2001 and three, when the market lost 49%, the S&P, that is, the Fed cut rates all the way down and the market kept going down. Same thing, obviously, in the financial crisis. So those, to me, are hints that, you know, isn't monetary policy may not be the end all panacea for every problem we face. Mm-hmm. And I do think that that is going to be one of the reasons why an awful lot of people who have adhered to the idea that, hey, all I have to do is buy the dip and I'm going to be okay. And retail investors, for the most part, this year, Tom, have been buying the dips progressively. That is so opposite of the behavior of retail investors, small traders, that went on for decades. Mm-hmm. They used to get scared out at bottoms. Now, hey, I'm going to buy the dip, you know? So I think there's a lot of changes coming as a result of exactly your question, that quantitative easing has in fact shaped and changed people's, you know, market responses and behavior.
Mm-hmm. And to that point, do you think that, you know, as you're talking about the Fed in essence losing control, is that because of the diminishing returns of or that marginal utility of debt not having the same effect that it did or that it once did?
Yep.
You know, when they were able to inject maybe $1 trillion into the economy.
Yeah, it's twofold. Obviously, fiscal plays a role in that, and really starting in 1981 and going forward, you know, the idea of using the combination of fiscal and monetary policy to minimize economic slowdowns or recessions, mm-hmm. which has been true, and they've accomplished that goal. But then you always avoid flushing out the weakest hands. And so you got a lot of dead wood still in the economy that otherwise in prior times where you did actually have a real recession and swept those folks and companies out of the thing, out of business, you know, we're stuck with that. So, yeah, I think the Fed has just overplayed its hand. And now I think they're in a box, you know, in terms of they've gone down this path and there's really no turning back. And the point you raise is a really, really important point, Tom, because in the 60s, each new dollar of debt, and again, this relates more to fiscal policy, would generate 60, 70, 80 cents of GDP growth. Mm-hmm. And as we've added more and more debt since 1981, because it became cheaper to do so as rates came down, the kick from each new dollar of debt has progressively dropped. And over the last decade or so, is generating less than 50%. Or 50 cents on the dollar. So what we have is debt is growing faster than GDP. And I use this analogy. It's kind of like getting fat by eating your own leg. You know, you can do that for a while, but it doesn't work for the long term. And that's what we're doing. We're doing more and more debt. It's generating less bang for the buck, which implies that not only, if I'm right about a secular bear market coming, the other component will be that fiscal policy will also lose some of its mojo. And the other point I would make is if you look at charts of velocity of money, and this is important because if the Fed increases money supply by 10% and velocity of money drops by 10%, you're not going anywhere. And what we've seen since the mid-90s is velocity has consistently been lower and lower and lower. So it's another aspect of more liquidity, more debt, and yet we're not getting the same bang for the buck because velocity is a function of money supply and GDP growth. Mm-hmm. So again, those are two of the main reasons why I think we're setting up for a secular bear market sometime starting 2-3 years from now. You know, that's just a guess, but I think it will catch the majority of investors completely off guard because they've been used to up, up and away really since 1982. Mm-hmm.
Just going back to something else you said, Jim, about when the Fed kind of changed their mandate to basically target average inflation, you know, you made the point that they were behind the eight ball or behind the curve the entire time once they started that. So Do you think that that was the beginning of the Fed being behind the curve because of that change?
Well, it laid the groundwork for them to become way behind the curve. In other words, if we didn't have everything that has taken place in terms of supply chain disruptions, $6 trillion of money being injected by the government to goose demand at the same time where supply was somewhat being restrained, you know, so it's like the perfect storm. But it laid the groundwork so that when inflation got going, the Fed was progressively more and more behind the curve. And I understand why they were sticking to the transitory narrative, because some of this stuff was, you know, special one-time types of things. But again, what they underestimated was the surge in demand and how persistent that would be and what it would mean in terms of the inflation of goods initially. And then now we're seeing it show up in services. So it's, again, a perfect storm. But yes, average inflation targeting, they had done that 10 years ago, you know, everything would have been copacetic. And in 2012 is when the Fed initially formalized its target for 2% inflation. Mm-hmm. And the one thing I say is, all right, 2% inflation in 36 years, it doubles, you know, the rule of 72. Well, that means in 72 years, it quadruples. So someone born in their lifetime, they live, the average lifetime is 78 to 80, they're going to see prices quadruple. And so somehow that, I guess, fits the definition of stable prices for a central banker. Oh, prices, well, we hit our targets perfectly. Prices only quadrupled in the last 75 years. Really? So to me, the whole idea that they need to have 2% as the target, again, is a bad starting place. Mm-hmm. Because over time, the erosion and the increasing cost of living, the erosion of incomes and so forth, it just... stupid. Mm-hmm. There's no justification. And I don't believe there's anything in economic literature that really supports that decision that, okay, we got to have 2%. And now every central bank on the planet pretty much is at that 2% threshold.
Mm-hmm. Or 2% goal.
Thank you. In this day and age, that's it. And so, you know, all these things are going to be important in the next 6 to 12 months, Tom, as we see the economy slow. Inflation is going to come down, as we'll talk about. But how insistent and impatient will the Fed be in terms of getting to that 2% target sooner rather than later? And I think that's going to be where the rubber meets the road. Mm-hmm.
I've told the story, I think, once before on the show, but my grandma last year for Christmas gave me a fresh, crisp $100 bill that was printed in 1979. And just as an instructive, you know, being kind of a monetary nerd, I guess.
Yeah.
I sat down with her and I said, you know, I wish you would have bought gold with this, number one, but we sat down and we calculated, and that $100 bill was now worth about the equivalent of $23. And, you know, my grandma was always a saver, and I appreciated obviously her gift, but it was just so crazy to sit down and actually think about the destruction of the purchasing power of something that she saved and valued so highly back at that time. And the effect of all this, you know, inflation and printing on that
value,
that vehicle, right?
Yeah. No, I mean, it's kind of like the old story of you put a frog into lukewarm water and slowly increase the heat. And in effect, that's what happened. You know, at 2%, you don't feel much. It's not that bad. Not that bad. But then you go 40 years later and you're like, okay, this $100 is going to buy me $23 worth of goods and services in today's, environment. Now that's a great lesson. Mm-hmm. Great lesson.
So Jim, you sent me a bunch of charts here, and of course the visual on YouTube, this will be a bit better than the audio version, but we'll do our best to explain it, to those listening on audio only. So we'll start with your recession chart.
Yeah. Basically, Tom, what we're going to do is look at, you know, where we are in the U.S. economy today and what factors are going to help us evaluate and determine whether we're going to see a recession or not and so forth, and then how that will potentially impact markets. So a lot of talk has been going on in the last month about, oh, we could already be in a recession. And everybody points to, well, see, the first quarter was down 1.6%. And the thing that people have to understand is when the Commerce Department calculates GDP, it's gross domestic product. So all they're looking for is what kind of production did we see within the United States? So that if we get something from overseas that comes in, we're going to subtract that. And so in the first quarter, we had the biggest trade deficit in history, and it's subtracted over 3% from GDP. So if you removed the impact of trade and you looked at things like final demand, and this is the point, you know, I've tried to make, is that if demand is healthy and so healthy that you have to fulfill some of that demand by getting stuff overseas, well, that's not the sign of a recession. And the NABE, National Bureau of Economic, NEBR, National Economic Bureau of Research, whatever it is, NEBR, they wouldn't look based on the way they evaluate, and they are the outfit that determines whether we're going to see a recession or when it begins and so forth. They wouldn't look at the first quarter as being a negative GDP. But there's a lot of people on the bandwagon. Oh yeah, we're already in a recession. They use the technical recession. Mm-hmm. So to me, that's just misnomer. And then because the Atlanta Fed, they come out with a number every week and it's at minus 1.6%. Oh gosh, we're already in a recession. I just think that that's way overplaying. And it just seems like there's an awful lot of people out there that want to look at the glasses half full without just being objective. In the first quarter, final demand was up 3.7%. That is a really healthy number. So, but that's the story that's going in. I think next week, Tom, we get the first estimate for second quarter GDP. And if it has a minus in front of it, you can be sure a lot of headlines next Friday are going to be U.S. in recession, you know. But again, I try to provide information for myself so I can evaluate what's really kind of going on. And obviously for people who subscribe to my letters, so they can determine what's BS and what's real. So to me, this is, you know, the idea that the recession drumbeat is way too loud relative to really what it should be. So,
and of course, there's some base effects that have a part to play in looking at these numbers, right? This comparison, this year over year comparison, right?
Yeah, because you had a lot of stimulus a year ago, and that stimulus isn't there. But the main thing of why first quarter GDP was quote unquote negative was because of trade, because we bought so much stuff from overseas and they subtracted it from gross domestic production.
But Jim, isn't that, you know, just kind of a, you know, an artifact of the fact that really the US doesn't produce that much stuff, and we've been in a trade deficit for many, many years.
Yeah. Yeah. No, this is, you know, just more of the same. It just, again, get exaggerated because, you know, again, so much money was given to people, whether they were working or not working. I mean, I get it in terms of unemployment benefits and so forth, somebody's out of work. But they handed out, I think, two or three checks, Tom, to people fully employed. Here's $1,400. Here's $1,200. And I think there was another one for either $600 or whatever. So that led to and then you're cooped up at home. So people went online and bought a lot of stuff. So that exacerbated the trend that you noted. We've had trade deficits for a really long, long time because we did offshore so much of our production over the last 20, 30 years. And some of that is beginning to be reversed, but it's going to take years. Okay. You know, the other thing, consumers represent about 65 to 70% of GDP. So consumer spending is really the little engine that keeps our economy going. And because people were locked up at home and because they got a lot of money, they built up an awful lot of savings. Going into this year is about $2.5 trillion. So the cushion to absorb higher inflation is much higher than it historically would ever have been. So people have been able to pay higher prices, A, because they want to go out and live a little bit and pay up for various things. So that has muted some of the negative impact. But that savings obviously isn't going to last forever. Now, I've seen the second chart, personal savings rate, on a number of places, and people reference it, and they're completely wrong. They said, well, look at the savings rate was 33%, and now it's down to 5.5 or whatever the number is, all right? And that means all the savings is gone. No, this is a monthly snapshot of how much people saved that month. The first chart, excess savings, is a cumulative chart, which shows that, yeah, when people weren't out spending money and they got money, they saved an awful lot of it. So, you know, the point being is savings have come down. But which means that the first chart isn't going to keep going up. It's going to be starting to come down because the bottom 20 and 40%, especially the bottom 20%, Tom, if you add up how much is spent on shelter, food, energy, electricity, you're talking about 75% of their disposable income. So the bottom 20% have probably already, for the most part, run through whatever savings they had. They're undergoing a big, big squeeze for those things. The middle class is probably around 50%. So they're being squeezed, but they had more savings. Not ignoring the fact that inflation is taking a toll, but it's working from the bottom up. You know, for a lot of people in the top 50% of income, it's an inconvenience. It's something over cocktails to whine about. The bottom 20, 40%, hey, it's painful. The bottom chart shows, if you will, the household balance sheet. And what we can see is after the financial crisis, household debt to income came down a lot. Well, that was like forced savings in the sense that people defaulted on their mortgage, which was the biggest issue of debt. So it came down very significantly, but also because the Fed has lowered rates and then kept them low for so long, people were able to refinance mortgage debt at lower and lower rates. So again, debt service as a percent of income is at a really low level. So what it underscores is that for the majority of consumers, they're in a decent position to withstand, if you will, some of the inflation that they're experiencing. So the idea that we're going into a recession, already in a recession, to me, these charts kind of argue, no, it's not happening right here, right now. Next year, a completely different story. So my view for months has been recession in 2022 is really, really unlikely for all these reasons. Next year, as more and more savings gets eroded, and depending on just how aggressive the Fed has to be, next year could be a whole different ballgame in terms of recession. Mm-hmm. But I don't think this year's, the case.
Mm-hmm. Jim, we've heard that, credit card balances have gone up dramatically as well. So yep. Do you take that into account here?
Yeah, I've shown that chart, Tom. I'm glad you brought that up in a number of my letters. Mm-hmm. And we're just back to where we were prior to the pandemic. So it's another symptom. If you're being squeezed and you're running down your savings, you start to use your credit card. So to me, the increase in credit card debt is a symptom of the squeeze that's happening on the bottom 40% of wage earners. And it's a sign of stress. Credit card debt, if you extrapolated the growth rate over time, extended it from February of 2020 out, we haven't gotten back up to, if you will, that trend line, but it's rebounded very, very significantly over the last 4 months. So it's a sign of stress, no question about it. Okay. Chair Powell has, numerous occasions used the phrase extremely tight in terms of the labor market. And obviously the unemployment rate being near a 50-year low is part of that equation. But the thing that he keeps referencing, data point, is the ratio of job openings to the number of unemployed workers. So the most recent number from the JOLTS survey was at the end of May. And there was 11.3 million job openings. And we're talking about 6 million or so unemployed people. So that's that ratio of 1 to 9. You can see historically, it's 50% higher than it was in 2018, which was a much, much higher in 2006 and 2007. So this is one of the things that Powell has emphasized. And it's why I think, and we're going to touch on it in a second, monitoring what happens with job openings is critical. What we're going to be talking about here basically is the labor market pipeline. So if I'm running a business and I'm needing employees, I'm going to advertise for more help, right? And so that's why we've seen this number rocket and companies are having, tremendous difficulty getting qualified workers. So if things start to slow down, what do I do? Well, I don't advertise for 10 positions. I advertise for 5. And I think that's one of the things we're going to see. Unemployment rate near 50-year low. And the other thing in terms of buttressing the consumer is wage growth. Yep, it's not as growing as fast as inflation, but it's not like it's super behind, but it's much faster than it has been in a long time. So that helps people, cope with higher prices. It buys some time. It's why the economy is not likely to just fall off a cliff, because the consumer is not in bad shape, both in terms of the balance sheet as well as current income. Mm-hmm. And then let's go to the next set of charts, Tom, because I think I jumped ahead just a touch. Okay, so Powell has talked about this job ratio to unemployment, and so to me, looking at if I'm running a business, as I said. Yeah, I wanted 10 people, but now all of a sudden, the last month or two, Tom, I'm reading about recession and everything else, and maybe I better dial it down again. So I'm only going to look for 5 people. Mm-hmm. That is what we're about to see happen. The next thing that happens, if I'm running a business, I don't want to let go of good people. So what I do is I start lowering the amount of hours that they work so that I can control my labor costs without letting people go. So the average weekly hours, you can see popped significantly. Well, that was a reflection of a surge of demand. They couldn't hire people fast enough. And so the existing employees were working more and more hours. But what we've seen is a combination of, hey, they added some more people. Maybe things are slowing just a tiny little bit. So they're catching up and now average hourly or weekly hours are back to where they were in 2019. So this is another, if you were gauge on that pipeline, we're going to see job openings decline. We'll see hours work start to decline. And then last but not least is unemployment claims. And to me, this chart is important because, as you can see, going back the last 60 years or whatever this thing goes, I think it's about 60 years, the troughs were around 300,000 in many business cycles. Well, we're at 250. So people are, again, those who are in the, oh, we're going into a recession camp. Look at unemployment claims are up. Yeah, but let's stand back and get a better perspective and look at historically, 250 is a really, really low number. So
the absolute level versus the relative level, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Cause we're coming off of an extraordinarily low base for obviously a lot of different reasons. But if you, if you're in the recession camp, you're looking for any data point that you can point to. See, I told you we're going to go into, it's like, come on already. A recession may be coming. I'm not disputing that. Mm-hmm. It's just, let's not hyperventilate right now. So again, this process of companies and how they manage their labor costs, these are the early warning signs. The last thing to move is the unemployment rate. Mm-hmm. That's the last resort. Charlie, I hate to let you go, buddy. I've been trying everything, but business is slumping. So we're talking months from now. And I can't remember which Federal Reserve, there's 12 different Federal Reserve boards and they all have research departments. And somebody came up with something that worked actually pretty good. The 3-month moving average of the unemployment rate, when it has increased by 0.5%, has usually been you're really on the doorstep of a recession. We're still at 3.6. So in other words, the 3-month average would have to get above 4.1. We're nowhere there, near there. Mm-hmm. So these are all the things I'm looking at, but that pending job postings, Tom, I think are critical because Powell has put so much emphasis on that ratio. So I think indeed, if you go to their website, you can get this data every week to see, how things are progressing. You can see it's easing slightly. So the aggregate number in JOLTS survey, as I said, it was like 11.3 million. The peak, I believe, 2 months or 3 months ago was 11.6. I got to believe, Tom, that has to drop probably below 8 million. Things are really starting to recede in terms of the demand for labor mm-hmm. before Powell will be convinced that, all right, the process of the extreme tightness in the labor market is beginning to unwind.
Mm-hmm. And of course, Jim, it's an important point to think about that these are all, let's say, leading indicators, and they're all reactions to kind of what the Fed is doing. Is that right?
Well, and changes in the economy. I mean, people who run businesses are reading what the Fed is doing. They're reading all this talk about recession and so forth, and they start incorporating that in terms of business expenditures. So am I going to increase my business investment in new equipment or a new factory if I think there's a recession on the way? No, I'm going to start to dial that back. So in the first quarter, business investment was up over 9%. Guess what? In the next few quarters, it's not going to be up over 9%. So you're right. People are responding to Fed, what they're reading about, and then what happens on the ground. What are they experiencing? Are they getting some orders that are being canceled? Are fewer diners showing up? Those are the real world things that then they make the tough decisions in response to. But that's why this is a process that happens over months and months. It's not like a switch, unless obviously you get a pandemic, and that's a whole different world than what we are currently living in. Mm-hmm. So, but again, what I'm trying to do here is for myself and for anybody listening and subscribers, what are the things to focus on? Paul has told us. He looks at this ratio of job openings to unemployment. He wants to see labor market ease, the tightness ease. That is at the cutting edge of tightness in labor markets. Mm-hmm. So that's why I think that statistic is more important than how many jobs were created last month. Mm-hmm. This is an advance warning of what's going to come. So
we always hear that the Fed is using, I think Danielle DiMartino Booth said that they're driving using the rearview mirror. So is this the most up to date data that they would be looking at, or close to it?
Well, I agree with that. I've used that analogy for a long time, that the Fed is basically, well, I'll add one point. Historically, monetary policy works with a 6 to 12 month lag. You know, they start raising rates slowly but surely. The higher cost of money starts to filter through the economy. They keep raising. Okay, so there is this built-in lag effect. So I would add this to that comment. The Fed is driving the car, looking through the rearview mirror. And what they're seeing in that rearview mirror, Tom, is what the economy looked like 6 to 12 months ago. So that's why the Fed is often, they wind up, and we've got a chart we're going to look at in terms of the success ratio of generating a soft landing. Mm-hmm. It's barely above the Mendoza line, referencing a baseball hitter's batting average of 200%. So anyway, that's the challenge. So when you think about it, when the economy starts to transition, as we're experiencing now, it is really challenging because you're always looking at data points that are somewhat old, you know. And but for me, given Powell's emphasis, looking at that job opening, he's telegraphing. What should I be looking at? The same thing Powell's looking at. And so the other things like the hours worked, unemployment claims, again, they're further down the pipeline. At the front end of the pipeline, how much labor are companies looking for? And that's the job postings. Mm-hmm. Okay, so, we talked about lagging indicator, job growth. And what we can see already is job growth has indeed been slowing. Now, part of that is a function of, when you get to closer and closer to full employment, there's fewer people to bring in off the sidelines. So it's not in this current environment, you could overread. Oh, look at job growth is slowing. Well, part of it is it's harder and harder and has been hard to get people to come to work. But just looking at the data as it is, we're seeing a slowdown. That is going to continue, I believe, in coming months. But if one is waiting for that number to turn negative or something like that, you're way behind the curve in terms of where the Fed might be going. The old phrase, don't skate to where the puck is, skate to where it's going. Mm-hmm. The Fed is looking at things like the job postings. The other thing, consumer confidence. All the people that are in the recession camp, this is one of the, look at consumer confidence, it's lowest in history and all that kind of stuff. Yep, there are two surveys. One is the Conference Board and then the University of Michigan. The University of Michigan, which is in the blue-purple number, you can see, man, it is low. It's the lowest since 1952. This chart doesn't go back that far. So I get the, oh my God, look at that. That's awful. But if you look at the Conference Board and the University of Michigan, how they've really moved together in recent decades, the relationship and correlation is extraordinarily tight. Up until about the last 9-12 months, look at the spread between them. It's gigantic. You say, well, how could that be? And as I've looked at this, Tom, and I've written about this a lot in the last few months, University of Michigan asks some questions that the Conference Board doesn't. The University of Michigan says, hey, is it a good time to buy a car? And consumers are saying no, mm-hmm. because car prices are up 11% and used car prices are up 40. And, there's not much on the lot. Is it a good time to buy? I don't think so. And they're right. Now, in prior cycles, when they said no, it was because the unemployment rate was going up. The economy maybe already was in a recession and they were worried about losing their job. They asked the same question about buying a house. Good time to buy a house? No. Prices are up 20%. Mortgage rates have almost doubled. It's a terrible time to buy. They're absolutely right. So my point, Tom, is that the gap is because of the questions that the University of Michigan asks and the response that consumers are providing, for the most part, in my opinion, there's being savvy. If we look at the Conference Board, the black line, look at where it is relative to history. So here we have the Michigan one below the lows of 2008 and 9, and the Conference Board is way, way up. So again, what we have is a bunch of people who are choosing to use one survey to make a point, as opposed to, hey, let's be honest, there's two surveys. Are we getting the same message from both? And the reality is, going back decades in the past, yeah, both of the surveys provided the same message. They're not providing the same message. And the reasons need to be understood. And in this case, I think consumers are actually being pretty smart and evaluating whether it's a good time to buy a house or a car correctly. Mm-hmm. So my point being is the conference board, I think, reflects the healthy balance sheet of most consumers, wage growth, plus, you know, house values have gone up. Well, a lot of people own house. Oh, stock portfolios. Yeah, they're down this year, but over the last handful of years, they've gone up pretty well. So again, to me, this kind of takes some of the steam out of, oh my God, consumers think the world's going to end soon. And that's why confidence is the lowest it's ever been. Okay. Leading indicators of recession. Yield curve. We hear a lot of talk about that. In the last few weeks, the 2-year has gone above the 10-year yield. So in other words, the 10-year, if it's at 3 and the 2-year is at 3.2, you got a negative yield curve of 0.2%. And we can see going back decades how inverted yield curves have done a pretty good job of saying, hey, there's a recession on the way. But the middle panel shows, what kind of a lead time? Well, the yield curve has a median lead time of 19 months. Okay, so it turned negative in July. So sometime maybe late next year, early 2024 would be the median time for a recession. I find that pretty useless information that far out because so much can change. In contrast, the leading economic indicator does a much better job. You can see the median on that is about 10 months. What I found is if you go to the Advisor Perspectives website, they have a lot of wonderful charts. So if you're into charts, that's one of the places you should try to get to destination-wise. They show not only just the raw data number, but they do a 12-month rate of change and a 6-month rate of change. And that shortens it from 10 months down to about 6. And we're still positive. Now, the next month, the number for the month of June should be coming out in the next handful of days. So again, this is another thing that argues that, hey, a recession isn't on our doorstep. It's more of a 2023 event, just like the yield curve is telling us. But you won't hear a lot of people talking about the leading economic indicators, Tom, compared to, oh, the yield curve inverted, oh my God. It's a good tool. I'm not demeaning it in any way. It's just the lead time to me is unsatisfactory. It's just too long. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, again, I think it's important to evaluate all of these indicators for how close they are and what their correlation is. And trying to always find better tools. That's a good point, Jim.
Well, or just, hey, I read something in the newspaper and I accept it at face value. Now, most people don't have the time or inclination as crazy people like me to dig, to look at the consumer confidence surveys and go underneath the surface to see that stuff and or dig deeper on this. And most people just, yield curve inverted. Oh my God, and they go a recession and blah, blah, blah. And so to me, to your point, it's really important to, I think have more objective, solid information in terms of what is the message truly coming indicators. And again, as I said, neither one is suggesting that a recession is on the doorstep. Okay, Federal Reserve. This chart doesn't go back to 1947, but I went back and got the data. Since 1947, there have been 14 rate hiking cycles, and he provided the circles. See, we can do a soft landing. Here they are. Here's proof. Yep. 3 out of 14. That's a batting average of 21%. All right. So it's not a high probability. So it doesn't mean it's zero. But if we look at what the Fed is facing right now, in terms of the challenges. A, inflation is at a 40-year high. It'd be different if inflation was at 3.5%, 4%. The odds of getting it closer to 2% without doing a lot of damage to the economy would obviously be much higher. So historically, when the inflation rate gets over 5%, the batting average for recessions is like 100%, where the Fed has to tighten enough to get inflation down, they wind up causing a recession. So, you know, I'm trying to be realistic here. We've kind of shown a number of charts of why a recession isn't on our doorstep. At the same time, the long view says, okay, the Fed has a lot of challenges. Complicating it even further are the supply side of the equation. In all these prior cycles, other than the mid-70s, you know, when OPEC came into existence and all that, supply issues weren't really a problem. Today, they're a big problem. And a couple months ago, Powell and the Fed said, you know what, we've come to this conclusion. We can't do anything about supply issues. So we got to curb demand, and we're going to curb demand by raising rates and slowing demand so that the supply chain can come into effect. And so to me, that means that monetary policy, in terms of actually being effective and bringing inflation down relative to history, is more likely to be less effective than as effective as in all these other cycles. So the bottom chart shows financial conditions. So basically, you know, interest rates are part of the equation in terms of what makes up financial conditions. Changes in the stock market. Hey, if it goes up, financial conditions are easing. Goes down, they're tightening. Treasury yields going up and down obviously reflect either tightening or easing. Spreads between treasury yields and corporate bonds. You know, if you think you're going into recession, you don't want to buy corporate bonds because the risk of default is obviously increasing. So those are the things that make financial conditions move up and down. So what we've seen is the Fed has moved, you know, relatively aggressively. But the financial markets, Tom, have moved even more aggressively in terms of how much the stock market has declined. Treasury yields have gone up very significantly relative to how much the Fed has raised short-term rates, the policy rate. So what this chart shows is zero is the day that they raised the Fed funds rate at the beginning of an interest rate cycle. So going back the last seven cycles, we can see that the blue line financial conditions have tightened way more in the last 100-120 days relative to mid-March when they raised the Fed funds rate for the first time to all the other cycles. So the point I've been raising is, we touched on it earlier, historically, monetary policy acts with a lag, 6-12 months. Well, if the Fed has tightened and the markets have tightened even more, then one would think that the lag time would be less. So we are, in my opinion, more likely to see the economy slow quicker than it did in these other tightening cycles because financial conditions have tightened more aggressively. So, you know, if you think about it, you know, the top 10%, you know, they have an enormous amount of, you know, their financial wealth in terms of stock market. Well, you know, and bond market. See, they get their statement in July. And like I said earlier, the 60-40 allocation, worst in decades. So on the bottom end, people are being hurt by rising prices for shelter, food, and energy, electricity. Top end, those stuffs are inconvenience. But the decline in asset values, they're real. Mm-hmm. And so that's another reason why I think we're going to see the economy slow. It's just a question of, does the Fed have to go a lot beyond the neutral rate? And Powell has said the neutral rate, which is, it's a theoretical concept. Right? There's no absolute number.
But yeah, I wanted to actually dig into that. You know, when you and I spoke, you were saying that Powell thinks 3.5% is neutral. So, you know, with inflation being so much higher than that, how is that possibly considered neutral?
Okay. Actually, Powell's in the 2.5% range.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But guys like Bullard would be more inclined to be up to the 3.5% range. The Fed's dot plot for early next year from the June meeting, I think, is at 3.4. Mm-hmm. So the concept of neutral is the federal funds rate is at a level that it is neither accommodative nor restrictive. In other words, there's some level that you go above that threshold and you're starting to actually tighten monetary policy. So Bullard gave a speech a few months ago, and he framed it better than I've heard other central bankers and, you know, most people frame it. He said, we're not tightening. What we are doing.
I have the quote in front of me because I pulled it and he said, there's a bit of a fantasy, I think, in current policy and central banks. Neutral is not putting downward pressure on inflation. It's just ceasing to put upward pressure on inflation.
Yes. Yeah. Absolutely right. I think I had that quote in one of my letters or, you know, because what he basically was saying is we're removing accommodation by getting to neutral. Now, again, it's a debate. Is it a 2.5? Is that 3? That they will work out at the various meetings. But the one thing that the Fed relies on forward guidance and big time, especially during periods of transition. And the whole idea is if we tell the markets what we're going to do and why we're going to do it, we'll get less volatility around whatever policy actions we're taking. So the problem with forward guidance is sometimes it's bad. I mean, it's wrong. So last year, hey, inflation is going to be transitory. They gave that month after month after month. They were wrong. Now, all of a sudden, they got to do a more abrupt 180. So that's the downside of forward guidance. But one has to pay attention to the speeches that the players on the FOMC are making. And you've got super doves like Kashkari from Minneapolis, and you got Bullard on the other spectrum, and Powell is somewhere near the middle. And evaluate their comments relative to, you know, their perspective. Are they a hawk or a dove? So what happened a few months ago was, I shouldn't say a few months, I think about 2 months ago, almost unanimously, they all came out, we have to get the Fed funds rate up to neutral as expeditiously as possible. And almost most of them used those words exactly, right? Mm-hmm. So to me, what that meant was that the Fed was going to continue to raise rates until we get to that quote unquote neutral level aggressively. So in January, you know, I was like, the Fed's going to front load this because they're behind the curve. They're going to raise in March, May and June. And then obviously the amplitude of those increases went from 25 to 50. And I thought they'd go 75 last month. I think all along, I thought they would go 75 in July. Why? Because that gets them up to 2.25, 2.5. And that gets them in the zip code of neutral. And I've used this analogy, Tom. It's like, hey, you're on an airplane. The pilot comes on. We're flying at 33,000 feet. And we're beginning our descent into our destination. So the descent from 33 to 10,000 feet is much, much faster, more rapid mm-hmm. than the descent from 10,000 to the ground. That's the idea of a soft landing. So again, to me, at some point in time, the Fed is going to downshift from 75 basis point increases to 50, and then at some point in time to 25. And the forward guidance is what we need to listen when that is going to be debated thoroughly at a meeting. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's, in my opinion, what's coming. So they have this meeting next week on the 27th. For 10 days, they don't talk prior to a meeting, no speeches or anything. I think when they come out of that meeting, on balance, we're going to see them continue to talk. We need to get inflation down. That's job number one. We'll do whatever it takes. And it's only as we get, they're going to get the July employment report, the July CPI in mid-August, until they get more and more data points before all of a sudden they'll start saying, well, you know, the Fed funds rate is close to our neutral level. And, you know, we've accomplished a lot. And in other words, they will never tell us they're going to downshift. Mm-hmm. You have to read between the lines. And that's where paying attention to forward guidance and the people who are saying this. So a week ago, Esther George, who is definitely more the hawk side, said, you know, and she's the type of person that when they were raising rates, wanted to raise them more. When they didn't raise them, she wanted to raise them. You know, so she has the hawk credentials. So she said, you know, we have to be careful not to tighten financial conditions too much. And I'm paraphrasing now, mm-hmm. to cause some kind of an accident that forces us to shift policy. So in other words, somewhere out there, we have to moderate our rate increases so that we accomplish our goal without creating a problem.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that's exactly what I was going to ask you, Jim. You know, considering that the Fed seems to always be behind the curve, do you think that they break something before they actually see it? And yeah. And what could cause them to do a 180 as they did on inflation?
Yeah. Well, A, that argues for them to obviously moderate rate increases. I think they're fully aware of it. I think, you know, the glib thing on what, all, I always raise rates until they break something, you know, and it's like, okay, the history kind of supports that. It's not like that's a flagrantly false statement. So I'm looking at like the dollar as an issue, you know, its extreme strength, how much the euro and yen have fallen. I mean, these are major currencies. They're down a lot. Emerging market currencies are down a lot, and you have dollar denominated debt in a lot of emerging markets. So is there, if I'm a business in an emerging market country and most of my revenue comes from my country, but I got this dollar denominated loan whose the interest is going up, but my currency just dropped. So my revenue has been depreciated by 10% because of the decline in my currency relative to the dollar. And I got to pay the interest expense to service that debt. So that to me is a risk where you could see something happen in emerging markets because of tightening too much. Mm-hmm. There's always financial institutions that are over levered, like 1998 with long-term capital management. They were levered 100-1 and they blew up. So those are the, you know, the black swans that no one can see, even the Fed. But I think George's comment, coming from someone who's more of a hawkish, and she's been on there for a while, so I think she garners some respect, is why I think leading into the September meeting, there's a good chance we will see some of the FOMC members potentially telegraph, we will be discussing whether to go 75 or 50 in September. And to the extent that that happens, I think financial markets are going to respond strongly to that. So it's just a question, when is that going to happen? I think it could happen leading up to the September meeting, which Excellent. Is September 21st, to be exact. Mm-hmm. So inflation, why is this such a problem? We'll go quick here. This just, you know, the first chart is, hey, going back 50 years, you can see if you're looking at a chart, that's a breakout, obviously, inflation. And again, it highlights the challenge that the Fed will have to try to get it back down, especially since there's a lot of supply constraints that they have absolutely no leverage over. Goods inflation, because people got a lot of money, they were locked at home, they bought stuff, and we're already seeing the shift away from goods toward services, and that's why goods inflation is coming down and service inflation is rising. Back in June, when Target and Walmart said, guess what, consumers are buying, they're just not buying a lot of the stuff we have on the shelves. So my point was that what's going to happen next? They're going to discount stuff and they're going to cut their orders for more goods. And we're going to see the ISM new order index drop below 50. And sure enough, in June, it dropped below 50. So some people are looking at the ISM, Tom, and saying, oh, look at every time it goes below 50. Oh, my God. I think, again, that's ignoring how unusual the cycle was, where people had all kinds of money. They bought, you know, computers, furniture, all kinds of stuff. Now they don't need all that anymore. Mm-hmm. They're going to services because things are opening up and we're seeing service inflation. And the point I made a few months ago was we're seeing goods come down. That's less than 15% of GDP. Services is more than 80%. So you can see a pretty good decline in goods that could be offset by things like shelter inflation, which are will continue to go up for the next 6 to 9 months, which is why core inflation may not come down as much. And then lastly, the breadth of inflation. Over 70% of the 200 components or categories within the CPI were up more than 5%. So we've seen this tremendous knock-on effect where, you know, prices went up. People thought they would be temporary. They weren't temporary. Now, all of a sudden, it goes down to the chain. And we're seeing more and more, like dropping a big boulder in a puddle and the ripples keep going out. This, again, underscores why I think it's going to be tough for the Fed to get inflation down. Will it drop to 4 and 5%? Yeah, I think that's coming. But getting it down below 3, that's going to take time. It's that simple.
Yeah, it seems like that's going to be quite a difficult feat, in my opinion, considering how high it actually is. And then the fact that they don't really have control of the supply side of inflation, and they're just trying to kill the demand side.
Yeah. And so, you know, again, getting back to the odds of a recession, the Fed pulling this off without tipping us in a recession are not good. Mm-hmm. You know, so I'm not in the, oh no, we're not going to have a recession ever camp. I just don't think we're likely to see it. And the main thing for the financial markets, which I think is key, do we get to a place in the hiking cycle where the Fed decelerates the magnitude? And if they do that, how are financial markets going to react? I think we're going to see the dollar come down. We'll see gold rally. We'll see equities rally.
Along with that, Jim, do you think that once they start to ease or, you know, back off of their rate hikes, do you think we'll see inflation start to pick right back up because of the actual supply side component of inflation instead of demand side? You know, once demand starts to pick up at all, isn't it going to cause inflation, or do you think that it's going to cause inflation to come right back?
I think there's going to be a lag time, Tom. You know, just because they go from raising 75, let's say I'm right, they go 50 in September, and maybe do 50 in November, and then they're talking maybe, you know, 25 early next year. They're still raising rates. So the economy is still going to be responding. Again, there is a lag effect to all what they've already done. Financial conditions have been tightened a lot. So I don't think that, just because they only go 50 instead of 75, inflation is going to turn around immediately. Now, oil, again, can be a wild card. When I look at the chart of oil, it looks like the high we've seen was a wave three a month or two ago. And we've had just a big A, B back up to 122 or so, C down to the low 90s for a wave four. So, you know, the whole story about what's going to happen in the next few months in Europe and energy and what Russia is going to choose to do is going to have a big impact on how quickly inflation could come back, to your point. So, you know, if oil all of a sudden is at 130, 140, you know, muscle memory will mean that prices will come back more quickly in that environment, you know. But, you know, we're in a very fluid, dynamic situation. So I always use the analogy, I'm driving a car. Somebody tells me there's a curve in the road 2 miles down. Do I stop looking out the front, you know, the window of my car? No, I just look at the, you know, when I get, whether it's 2 miles or 2.1 miles, oh, here's the curve. I'll adjust accordingly. And to me, now more than ever, we have to be focused on the right data points to be able to hopefully make informed decisions to keep us from getting run over. Because I still think there's a lot of risk. The risk of a recession next year is still, I think, you know, the probability of that is uncomfortably high. Mm-hmm. It's just, are we going to see this window of time where the Fed downshifts slightly and the markets overreact? Because we are in markets that love to overreact.
Well, and especially considering how the markets have learned from, let's say, the lows of 2020 and how, you know, I would say most people probably miss that, but they've learned, I better not miss the next time that happens.
Yes, absolutely. And last week we saw another example of that. You know, people after the CPI came out last Wednesday and the producer price index on Thursday, the Fed's going to go 100 basis points. Now, 3 weeks ago, because we had some soft economic data, commodity prices had come down, maybe the Fed will only do 50 in July. Mm-hmm. So we're, you know, markets are like hyper, it seems, at this point in time. Oh, maybe they'll do 100. And then one of the Fed governors, Waller, gave a speech and said, I'm still in the 75 basis point camp. And he's been pretty hawkish. I'm still in the 75 basis point. Unless we see the retail sales number come in much stronger than expected. So what happened Friday morning? Retail sales came in. They were up 1% versus 0.9 estimated, but not much stronger. And within minutes, the S&P rallied 50 basis points because now they're only going to do 75. So again, the way markets are reacting, they're just overreacting. And that's why
hypersensitive to the Fed.
Every single data point. Mm-hmm. Now, irony, you know, 4 or 5 weeks ago, the idea of the Fed doing another 75 in July probably would not have been met with cheers. But because they, oh man, they're going to do it. Oh, now it's only 75. You know, it's kind of like when I was a bad boy. Okay, go stand in the corner, Jim. You know, so, oh, okay, I only have to stand for 15 minutes instead of 20. You know, when you're a little kid, 5 minutes is a lifetime, let alone 15. Mm-hmm. But because Mark, oh my God, they're going to do 100. Oh no, it's only 75. Hey, you know, it's just kind of crazy. So the majority of people don't take, and I'm talking about professionals here on Wall Street, I don't think dig down into the details as much as is needed when you're in a different economic framework because of the pandemic, the response, and they're looking at indicators, Tom, and they're comparing them to indicators and how they've behaved in the last 50 years and drawing the same conclusion. I just don't think we have that luxury to do that. So again, the next month or so is going to be, I think, pretty dynamic. And I'm looking for a fairly significant rally in equities. I'm just not sure we're there yet. So I don't know. Can't remember where we are on the charts here. What's coming next? Okay.
Inflation relief.
Oh, yeah. You know, we've talked about it. You brought it up too. Hey, they don't have a lot of control, but there are some signs that things are starting to ease up. Supply chain pressures, they're rolling over. And what we can see is the dash line is the supply chain indicator. And we can see the dark line, which is the CPI and the PPI, they followed. So as supply chain issues are easing, it should help in terms of PPI, CPI down the road. You know, a few months ago, there was 100 and some ships outside of LA and Long Beach. It's down to 13. Computer chip, obviously car prices, used car prices through the roof. Well, this is South Korea, their inventory of chips. They're sitting on, all of a sudden, the inventories of chips are starting to go up. And I think part of it, Tom, was when you need 1,000 chips and you're having trouble getting them, let's order 1,500. Maybe we'll get 750, you know? So I think there was some over-ordering. And the net result is, I think, again, this isn't going to happen overnight, but all this stuff gradually improves. And as the Fed sees some of this, it makes it a little bit easier to downshift. And then housing affordability. In March, I did a big thing on housing and said, hey, you know, because affordability has obviously since then gone down more. But this has ramifications. If there's less existing home sales, which is about 85-90% of housing activity, you know, you get a new house and you wind up buying a new piece of furniture, or you get a new appliance. You do, you know, you buy stuff to fix it up in most cases. So again, in terms of helping the supply chain, the slowdown in housing will slowly but surely also mean that, okay, the top chart improves even a little bit more, you know? So these are the things that I think are on their way. They don't mean that inflation is going to, you know, 3% quickly. It just means inflation is going to start to work its way down in coming months. Mm-hmm. Okay. TLT. The green arrow you see in mid-June, Tom, is when I recommended TLT. It was trading about 110 and a quarter. And it was on the idea that from the high over in the left upper right-hand corner, you see 155. And the red numbers indicate pattern analysis, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And so in mid-June, it was like, hey, potentially, we've completed the decline that began at 155 and it ended at 108.12. And if that's the case, we're on the threshold of a rally that will retrace 38% to 50% of that 47-point decline. Now, what's happened since is the rally from 108 to 115 and change was, you know, 7 points or so. When you add it to 110 and you add it, it's like the two legs up were equal. So it almost looks like, okay, A, B, C. So it's possible, based on how they've behaved so far, that wave five is not yet completely in, that there's one more drop. So what I did was put a stop in at 116.10 on 40% of the position, and a stop on the remaining 16 at 113.50. In other words, we should respect that green trend line. And as you can see from the lows, we're making higher lows, and that pattern needs to continue if we're going to see TLT at least rally towards 119, 121. Mm-hmm. Wave four of lesser degree is the 119.74, or retrace a higher percentage towards 125 at 382. So this position was taken because we were going to see more data points showing the economy slowing, and that I thought would be supportive of lower treasury yields. I still think, one way or the other, I think there's a significant rally coming in treasury bonds and lower bond yields. What I don't know is, okay, we take out and we could go below 108. If it does, it will be a great, another great buying opportunity, because I think we're going to see yields come down. And obviously, if the Fed starts to hint as we get in December or September, pardon me, that they may go from 75 to 50, I think that would be somewhat supportive for bonds. Mm-hmm. So that's the take on the bond market. S&P. So the rally from the mid-June low, again, green alley, arrow, I was looking at the S&P to have a pretty good rally off that price level. And I thought it could get to 3,900 or so. We got to 3,946. And then you can see from 3,946, dropped to 3,739, then 3,918, and then last Thursday, 3,722. That looks like A, B, C. And so my expectation was that we would see a rally that could potentially take the S&P up to 4,031. And that target is basically saying, all right, it rallied 309 points from 36-37 in what I think potentially is wave A. We had the down, up, down pattern to the B question mark at 37.22. You had 309 points to 37.22, and you're at 4,031. Two legs being equal. If we get up at a minimum, the pattern suggested we would get over 39.46, which obviously today we have. The key, we get up towards 4,031. The question mark is, all right, how much of a pullback are we going to see? I think there's still a risk that we'll see a retest of 36-37 between now and Labor Day, or at least a decent size pullback. So I don't think this is a good place to be going long. I thought mid-June was a good opportunity based on, you know, the pattern analysis that I had done back then. Mm-hmm. If I'm right, again, about Fed policy downshifting, Tom, we'll see a pullback. And then I think there's a very good rally that takes us September, October. And the S&P topped at 48.18. If 36.37 is the low, call it 1,200 points just to make the numbers simple. You know, a 618 retracement, it would be 700 and some points. You're talking 4,400. So my expectation is that 4,400 is possible as we get out to September and October. It's just a question of, are we going to see a pullback of some magnitude between now and the end of August? And I think the answer is likely, because I think the Fed's still going to talk tough after this meeting next week. And, you know, the data, I don't think, is going to come in. You know, the economy is still going to show signs of slowing. Earnings have not really been cut materially by Wall Street. I think that's yet to come. The dollar strength is going to weigh on international companies, and the S&P companies get over 40% of the revenue overseas. So there's a lot of companies, Tom, that are really feeling the squeeze. IBM the other day came out and said their revenue was hit by about 5.5% due to currency. So I just think there's more headwinds coming before we get to that place where the Fed can signal that they have the opportunity to maybe to downshift. Okay, gold. I'm going to talk the bottom part. This is positioning in the futures market, commitment of traders report, and it shows large speculators. And what we can see is since March, when gold traded at 2,066, the large speculators have kind of tossed in the towel, you know, and I get it. You and I, when we spoke a few days ago, you know, we were talking about, gee, it's kind of amazing. In August of 2020, gold hit 2,070. At that point in time, the CPI was 1.5%. Here we get to 9%, and it's at $1,700. So if gold is supposed to be a hedge against inflation, gee, didn't help very much. Mm-hmm. You know, part of it was dollar strength. Last year in June, I was looking for the dollar to make a bottom around 90 and rally to 103. And we saw that, and that proved to be a bigger headwind than the tailwind from inflation. So the positioning sentiment is obviously sour towards the metal. know, gee, it didn't do what it's supposed to do. Inflation's up and it didn't help me. The pattern is, again, what I'm keying off of. From the high in August of 2020, gold dropped over $300 to that wave A level. Then a choppy ABC rally up to last March at 2066. And now we've done, I think we're near the end of a C wave from 2066 that potentially completes the correction that began in August of 2020. So at a minimum, I think gold is going to rally towards 1850, just in terms of a relief oversold bounce. Potentially, this pattern, if this pattern proves to be correct, and there's always more than one pattern, Tom, as you well know, but this pattern implies that a test of the highs, you know, 2050, 2070 is also on the table. But right now I'm looking at buying gold. I've recommended taking a 33% position and then another 33% position a few days ago when it spiked down under 1720. And if it drops below 1795, you know, that low, I think by wave A was 1677. So there's a chance you could see it drop below that. But I think the positioning, sentiment, the pattern all imply that we're near what could be a fairly decent trading low and a rally back up, as I said, to 1850. So that's a decent trade and potentially it could turn into a really good trade if this pattern is correct and a move back towards the highs is going to happen by early next year. So,
if your pattern is proven correct there and we're going to retest those highs, you know, of 2050, 2070 there, do you have any sort of a timeline on that or is it,
I think
just the pattern itself,
my guess. Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, time is always a function, you know, the decline from the August peak to the March of last year's low was about 7 months, the decline from the March high, you know, so could it happen by early next year? That would be my guess. And again, if the Fed downshifts, you know, you could get, again, one wave one up, wave two down, Fed downshifts, and you get a huge wave three move that encapsulates maybe 90% of the move in a short amount of time. And then you do some chopping around with a final push up in early next year. So that's my best guess. But I do think buying gold near 1700 is going to be a good trade. And lastly, the dollar. So you can see higher highs, higher lows, definitive uptrend. From the low in January, to me, it looks like you can count one, two, three, and maybe we've had a wave four pullback and that there's one more new high coming. And in other words, that would imply one more new low, lower low in the euro. The euro is 57% of the dollar index. So a drop below the recent low we saw at 99.50 something, I think could set up the euro for a very good trading low and the dollar topping out. One of the triggers could be what happens in the next week or so with the Nord Stream pipeline being turned on. It's supposed to be announced on Friday. Do they turn it on at 20% of volume? 40% of volume? You know, I think that's a realistic that they turn it on, but not at a level that will really help Europe build up natural gas reserves going into the winter. And if I'm Putin, I would wait. You know, the claim is we need a turbine that's in Canada to help us, you know, pump more. And, you know, I think potentially that's just a rouge. You know, Europe and Germany especially are facing a really cold winter. And German industry, their chemical industry, is heavy users of net gas. So if I'm Putin, do I play that card immediately or do I wait till like November? Right on the doorstep of winter, you know what? We've got some more mechanical problems. But that is the dependency and the wild card in a lot of this stuff. If they don't give Europe, you know, net gas at you know, a decent level, you know, economically, Europe is going to really get hurt. I mean, I think a recession for Europe is done. It's a done deal. They're going into a recession, given what's happening with energy, and all the rest of the dynamics. But this is a key thing. Again, the idea that gold could be making a low coincides with the pattern in the dollar that it's near a high. Either it has made the high or we get one more higher high to complete five up from the low, actually going back to March and more recent low, the low in late May. So I think we're at a pivotal time.
Excellent, Jim. Well, I think that's all the charts we have there.
Well, I want to thank everybody who persevered. I'm sorry we did run long, but man, I'd like to think that we covered an awful lot of ground and hopefully provided people with a framework of what to expect in the next handful of months. So I appreciate you giving me the time and the opportunity.
Yeah, not a problem, Jim. I appreciate you taking the time and being so generous with, you know, a lot of the things that you look at, how they all fit together, and sharing your thinking with us on that. Of course, your newsletter is available at macrotides.com. And sure. On Twitter, you're a good follow too, at Jim Welsh Macro. And I believe you had an offer for some of our listeners
there. Yeah. Anybody who would like to receive a recent, either I do a monthly macro tides issue, which really focuses more on the fundamental side of the equation, Tom, and then a weekly technical review, which has some fundamental, but is more focused on chart analysis and so forth of the markets. I'm happy to provide listeners to your show, a couple of the recent issues. I think it'll get a better idea. Just send me an email. Jim Welsh, WELSH macro at gmail.com. And I'm happy to send one.
Perfect. Thanks so much for your time and your expertise today, Jim. Really appreciate it.
Hey, again, thank you, Tom, for the time. Appreciate it.
This podcast is for general informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests on this show are not compensated for their appearance. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. Do not base any investment decisions on the information contained. To view our full disclaimer, please visit our website.